So where I've come today for Tales of the Battlefields podcast is a very famous place that I've never been to before as a civilian, and it's the Royal Military Academy in Sandhurst. There's so much history here. I've just done a guided tour of the main parts of the academy, and so with so much history going back. But that's not what we're talking about now for this podcast this week. I'm with a man called Will Tower, who is now the Regional Director of the South East for the Army Benevolent Fund. And we're going to talk about the battle for Crete and what happened there, because the latest addition to the frontline walk is a trek across the evacuation routes of Crete. But before we talk about that, Will, tell me about your background with the Army, because I understand you've got quite a career and heritage.
A heritage and career, I think probably less of a career, but a lot of fun. I've been in the Army prior to joining the Army Benevolent Fund for 35 years. I was in the Coldstream Guards. I came through here at the Royal Military Academy of Sandhurst as an officer cadet in 1984, and then joined the 2nd Battalion Coldstream Guards and was fortunate enough to carry the colour on the Queen's Birthday Parade in 1985. Since then, I have had a lot of fun in the Army. Did 16 operational tours, lots in Northern Ireland, Bosnia, Kosovo, Sierra Leone, 3 tours of Iraq and 4 tours of Afghanistan. And in between all of that, done a lot of ceremonial in London.
Did you have any spare time at the end of that?
Oh, absolutely. Yes,
some fun.
So, a lot of fun.
So, working for the Army Benevolent Fund, the Frontline Walk has been going since 2014, and regular listeners will know that we've done a few podcasts about the Frontline Walk, and we've been to Normandy, and we've been across the Western Front, and those treks will be going again this year for the 11th year that we'll have done that. But you've introduced a couple of new treks to the options of the Frontline Walk. Tell us about those.
Certainly. Well, I realised very early on the fact that the Frontline Walk was a great success story for the charity, but I wanted to do a smaller version of it to make it more bespoke and have a smaller number of people going, but really try and make it more challenging. And rather than focusing upon Northwest Europe, which a lot of people know quite a lot about, whether it be First World War or Second World War, I wanted to concentrate on Second World War, and in particular, initially look at the Pyrenees and the escape routes used by individuals escaping from Nazi persecution during the Second World War, escaping from France over into Spain.
And you've done a couple of those?
We've done a couple of those. We did the first one in 2023, and then which was very successful, following the traditional Chemin de la Liberté route from Saint-Girons across the High Pyrenees in the Ariège region. And then last year, in 2024, we did a slightly separate route in the Pyrenees Orientales, following a route that basically took us down across the mountains towards Barcelona.
And that's following the routes of the SOEs used?
Very much so. I mean, there's a huge history.
Which we forget about.
We completely forget about. And it is written up, but it doesn't get as much, I suppose, exposure as it should. And there were some very famous SOE operators, in particular two females, Nancy Wake, known as the White Mouse, who was quoted as being the most hunted individual by the Germans in the Second World War.
So they knew about her then?
Yes, they certainly knew about her.
They couldn't catch her.
They could not capture her at all. And another fascinating story about an individual by the name of Virginia Hall, who was actually an American but worked for the SOE, and in her early life working for the American Diplomatic Corps, sadly had a hunting accident climbing over a fence in Turkey near Izmir, and shot herself in the left foot, which then led to her left leg below the knee being amputated. And she had a prosthetic leg fitted, and she nicknamed it Cuthbert. And anyway, she was responsible for getting a number of people out on the Pato Liri line, which is one of the many escape routes over the Pyrenees.
So these would have been crashed airmen and people.
Absolutely like that. And escaped
prisoners of war. Yeah.
And one in particular you will know of, Airy Neave, who escaped from Colditz. Initially went to Switzerland, and then he went through France, and then made the route that we covered last year over the Pyrenees Orientales.
Yeah.
And amazing story, longer term, but Virginia Hall, having got this prosthetic leg, realised the fact that Gestapo were closing in on her, and she made an escape herself with her prosthetic leg over the mountains. And the story goes that halfway across the mountains, she was struggling a bit, And she got on the radio set back to London to get in touch with them and let them know the fact that Cuthbert, her leg, was actually causing a bit of a problem.
So she's assumed that the person at the other end knew who Cuthbert was.
Absolutely. And the message came back saying, if Cuthbert is proving to be a nuisance, eliminate him. But what an amazing story for someone with a prosthetic leg.
And she carried on.
Do the crossing.
She didn't give up, she carried on.
And it meant the fact that we doing the crossing could have no excuse whatsoever to continue.
And how long does that frontline walk last?
It's only 5 days.
Only?
I say only. And actually, as the crow flies, it's only, literally, about 50 kilometres. But you are crossing over various peaks that are roughly in the region of about 2,400 metres high. So we cross three of those.
Is there oxygen issues as well?
Not at all, no.
No, it's not that high. No. But you're carrying your own stuff with you, aren't
you? Carrying all of our own kit. We had the most amazing group of people on both of the treks we've done thus far.
Yeah.
And really managed to gel as a group. Accommodation, a bit ropey to put it mildly, on occasions, because you're staying at a different place every night.
Yeah, yeah.
There was one occasion we spent a night with 21 of us all in the same room, more like a dormitory.
I bet.
But what a great bunch. Everyone managed to have a drink most evenings.
And you become friends for life, don't you?
And you do become friends for life. Everyone keeps in touch.
Yeah.
And we set up a small WhatsApp group. And I think joining the bigger group of the frontline walk.
Mm, definitely. So Crete then, was this be? Is this the first time?
So this is the first time we're going to Crete.
Yep.
We've realised the fact that we wanted to try and make it slightly more exciting. We've done the Pyrenees twice. We thought we can't continue with the Pyrenees every year, otherwise people get probably a bit bored with it.
Yep.
That having been said, Crete has the most amazing history. Hopefully it's got the most amazing weather as well.
Yeah.
But in this case...
When is the Crete?
So the Crete trek is going to be from the 8th to the 14th of September.
September, yeah. It's pleasant then, isn't it?
Very
September.
Much so, but hopefully sort of not as hot as it might have been in the sort of deep
August.
Summer.
Yeah.
And at the moment we've got 11 people taking part in the trek.
Yeah.
And we're very much following, from a history point of view, the German invasion of Crete following the collapse of Greece in April 1941, covering Operation Mercury, which was the effectively the parachute drop.
The German parachute, coming from the air.
Coming from the air, trying to capture three airfields, one at Malamé, which is in the west of the island, the second one being at Retimo, and the third one being in Heraklion.
Mm.
And the German invasion took place on the 20th of May 1941. And to be honest, from an Allied point of view, defending the island, they had very little heavy equipment, because this was really only about a couple of months on from Dunkirk.
Mm.
So
we weren't really
in a position. We weren't prepared for it at all. Mm. So we had very little heavy equipment. The Germans had air superiority, so the Luftwaffe were causing havoc throughout daylight hours. Luckily, the Luftwaffe didn't fly at night.
Did we have RAF there?
We did have RAF, but the RAF basically withdrew back to North Africa, in particular Egypt, to help the campaign there a few days before the invasion, realising the fact they were likely to get overrun.
Mm. And I understand, though, that Hitler wasn't completely happy with the parachute landing.
No, not at all.
Didn't want to do it again, did he?
The idea was very much from a general Kurt student who was basically the catalyst of the individual who basically brought together the airborne forces to do massive parachute drops. And the idea was the sort of oil spot mentality of basically, if you imagine putting a drop of oil over some water, and those were the landings over Malamé, Retimo, and Heraklion airports, the three airports in Crete, and in theory, capturing the airfields, and then as the oil spreads, effectively, they take over the island. That was the theory behind it.
Right. Did it work in practice?
In practice, no, it didn't, because in the early hours of the 20th of May 1941, the first landings came in, parachuting in to Malamé, and due to winds in the wrong direction and basically a bit of a mix-up in the plans, the German intelligence thought the fact that there were very few Allied troops there and thought there were probably only the best part of 1,500 individuals there. In reality, the Germans were outnumbered 6-1.
And who were they fighting against? Were they fighting against the Greeks?
So they were fighting against the Greeks, and in Malamé, the area that I'm concentrating on this trek, very much the New Zealand infantry
battalions. The New Zealanders there. Wow.
And really, the story I'm concentrating on in the form of telling the tale about the trek we're doing is based upon the 22nd New Zealand Infantry Battalion, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Leslie Andrew, who won a Victoria Cross in the First World War.
That's a story then to follow.
It is, very much so. And he was made commanding officer of the battalion. They basically were sent out to Greece initially. Greece became a bit of a disaster because it was a number of delaying actions because the Greek army effectively surrendered, and it was only a matter of time. It was buying time to allow people to be able to withdraw off to North Africa. In the case of Crete, what happened was the Royal Navy did the most fantastic job in extracting people from Greece and got the best part of 15,000 people off Greece.
Off the mainland, yeah.
But the fast boats, fast destroyers and battleships managed to get people away down to Crete and then managed to do a fast turnaround to go back and collect more.
Okay.
But some of the bigger troop-carrying ships went direct from Greece down to North Africa.
Right.
So there was very much a makeshift force from the Allied side left in Crete with very little equipment, based in the west with the 5th New Zealand Infantry Brigade, of which 22nd New Zealand Infantry Battalion was one with Lieutenant Colonel Leslie Andrew, VC. And then you've got the Australians at Retimo, that is to the west of Suda Bay. And then much further to the west, you've got the British garrison at Heraklion.
So we just pause the interview there because Will mentioned Leslie Andrew, VC, who was very much part of the story on Crete. But as he said, he was awarded the Victoria Cross for his actions at Messines in the Ypres salient in June of 1917. He'd arrived in France in September 1916 and fought with the 2nd Wellington Battalion on the Somme, but he was wounded. Returned to the New Zealand forces, and following the successful attack at Messines in June 1917, the Germans launched a number of counter-attacks only to lose more ground. And the New Zealand 1st Brigade captured the tiny village of La Basseville, a few kilometres southeast of Messines, and this was the 22nd of July, so some 6 or 7 weeks after the main attack. The New Zealanders had been driven out soon after, and they'd suffered serious casualties during these actions, many from a German machine gun post. So on the 31st of July, and this is the day that the Battle of Passchendaele began, the New Zealanders attacked the village once again. The 1st Auckland Battalion was to hit the German defences, while the 2nd Wellingtons was to take the village and establish positions there. Shortly after 4 a.m, the New Zealanders began advancing behind an artillery barrage, this creeping barrage that we talked about before. Andrew led two sections sent to destroy the machine gun position, and as they moved forward, they saw that another machine gun on the nearby railway line was holding up other New Zealand troops. They rushed the position, they killed the crew, and they captured the gun before turning back to their original objective. Approaching the machine gun position from the side, the New Zealanders crawled through thistles to within striking distance. They threw in hand grenades and they stormed the position, killing some of the Germans and capturing a second machine gun. While his men carried back the captured guns, Andrew and a private Ritchie scouted the area and found another machine gun in a trench. The two men rushed that position as well. They threw hand grenades in, they cleared it before returning to their company. He was just 20 years old at this stage, showing fantastic leadership. The citation said that Corporal Andrew's conduct throughout was an unexampled for cool, daring, initiative and fine leadership, and is a magnificent example, was a great stimulant to his comrades. And of course, such a young man, generation later, was to take those leadership skills to the Battle of Crete. He lived until 1969 when he died. All his military medals from both World Wars, including his Victoria Cross, are on display at the National Army Museum in New Zealand.
So the Anzac, they're a long way from home, aren't they?
Very much so. And of course, the reality of this is, as I said before, only a few months on from Dunkirk, an awful lot of the Antipodean, if I can call them that, soldiers, first of all, had never seen modern warfare.
No.
And the experienced commanders amongst them, Lieutenant Colonel Leslie Andrew, had had a lot of experience from the First World War, but that was trench warfare.
In trenches. This is open warfare,
isn't it? This is open warfare. And they'd never come across the blitzkrieg type of tactics that were employed by the Germans.
No.
So actually, very few people had really seen a mass amount of aircraft before in the past, and certainly haven't seen parachutes.
And they were using the same tactics that they'd used in Northern Europe and on the Russian front of what was to come and through Poland.
Yes,
very much so. And we're using things like Stukas.
Yes.
Which is terrifying.
Very terrifying. And basically, it meant the fact that Allied forces couldn't move during the day at all. They had to remain static because any movement attracts attention. And the Luftwaffe would close in on them and drop
bombs. About the civilians?
Civilians largely made themselves scarce.
Because they're in the front line, aren't they?
They were in the front line, but they largely made their way up into the mountains
to escape.
Yes.
Right.
And the reality of this, from the defender's point of view, was the fact that General Freyberg, who was the, in this case, sounds German, but actually he was the New Zealand general in charge of Crete, he was very much focused upon the fact that he'd got lots of reports back using Ultra and all the sort of from German intelligence and basically finding out from Enigma exactly what was going on. But at that stage, they'd only cracked the codes for the Luftwaffe.
This is early on in the war.
This is very on in the war. So they knew the Luftwaffe had great plans to attack Crete, but they didn't have any further information and assumed the fact that it was going to be mainly an amphibious attack. So they were focusing very much on defending the three airfields at Malamé, Retimo and Heraklion, but really focusing upon beach landings. So when it came to parachute drops, something they'd never seen before in this sort of size, it was a massive surprise.
I bet. How many were there? How many Germans came in by parachute?
Well over 1,800.
1,800, you mentioned that. That's a lot of people, isn't it, coming? And it, especially as a surprise.
Yes.
What happened then when they landed on the ground?
Well, they landed on the ground, and actually, as it turned out, it was a bit of a disaster for the Germans.
Yeah.
Because it became what can only be described as a bit of a turkey shoot. Because the defenders were on the ground, saw these people floating down, and shot a lot of them in the air. And that is allowed by the Geneva Convention. You immediately assume it's not allowed, but actually, if it's an act of war, it is. If you're bailing out of an aircraft because it's been shot down, then yes, you're not allowed to shoot.
But these were attacking troops, aren't they?
Attacking troops. And they landed, and a lot of them were killed on the way down. A lot of them were killed by the Greeks and also the civilians. Who they thought, the Germans thought at the time they were going to be welcomed with open arms.
Really?
But far from it. There were little old ladies wearing black from farms and things like that with pitchforks, and actually, literally, if a German soldier was stuck up a tree, they would finish him off.
Good for them.
So it was massive losses on the German side. They tried to follow this up. It started in Malamé with the drops there. That didn't go too well. They then tried Retimo later on at about 2 o'clock that afternoon. That was a complete disaster, and the Australians managed to massacre most of the Germans. And in Heraklion, with the British forces, again, most of the Germans got wiped out. So the immediate question is, so why did it all go wrong?
Well, that's what I'm just thinking. How did they manage to gain control of the island?
Because the reality was that, very sadly, in the case of the 22nd Infantry Battalion with Lieutenant Colonel Leslie Andrew, he only had a single company defending Malamé Airport, or airfield itself.
So it's numbers, then?
So it's numbers. Right. And what happened was the fact that there was such a massive onslaught by the Luftwaffe during the first day of the operation. And as far as he could see from Hill 107, where his command post was, he could see only a certain amount of the airfield and the battlefield in front of him. He had three companies to his front, and he was co-located with A Company on Hill 107. And he lost all communications with his three forward companies.
And they had no idea what was going on.
No idea, because they didn't have radio sets that worked. Mm. They had literally line that was laid using old field telephones.
He couldn't see,
he was too far away. Mm. And the other thing was that, of course, these lines had all been damaged by bombs being dropped by the Luftwaffe.
What blitzkrieg is all
about. So over a period of time, that first day, On the 20th of May 1941, he lost contact with his forward forces. He saw literally thousands of parachutists coming in all around him, not just in front. This is a man who's used to trench warfare, a very static warfare, not used to this sort of thing. Also during that day, sadly, he got hit by a bit of shrapnel and got hit in the temple. So he had flashbacks to, I suppose, battlefield stress, whatever you want to call it.
It would have brought back all those horrible memories.
Horrible memories of the First World War.
Yeah.
And he then sent out runners to his forward companies who never managed to get as far as forward companies because they were intercepted by individual groups of Germans who had parachuted in.
So runners immediately takes you back to the trenches again.
Absolutely. And then, horror of horrors, he basically took on board the fact that he needed reinforcements urgently. So he got in touch via field telephone to his brigade headquarters, to Brigadier Hargis, New Zealand brigade commander, and asked him for reinforcements. And he said, well, we'll do what we can do, but we really are not able to spare anyone. And originally there was a plan for a full infantry battalion to be able to come back in and...
So they weren't on Crete?
Yes, they were on Crete.
They were still there, they were still just there. In a different part.
Different part,
right.
Actually a few kilometres further away.
Yeah.
And the reality was the fact that he was not able to send reinforcements.
So they were isolated.
So they were isolated. He did, in the end, send two companies of reinforcements off in two separate locations, but neither of them managed to actually break through to follow up, to work in the area he wanted, and both of them withdrew back to their battalion. So the reinforcements never really occurred, and Lieutenant Colonel Leslie Andrew, realising or thinking the fact that it was all going pear-shaped, decided to pull out and basically sent a message back to Brigade Headquarters saying, I need to withdraw because we're being overrun.
That must have been a difficult decision.
Difficult decision. But, of course, he didn't know the reality because, actually, the troops on the ground at the airfield
were holding it
and doing a very good job. So when the message came through to them, eventually, to withdraw, they asked the question, why? Because, actually, we're holding the ground.
We're doing okay.
And, eventually, they pulled out that evening, the night of the 20th/21st of May, and, in doing so, allowed, basically, the Germans to reinforce at Malmain. And that started off with a Junkers 52 aircraft coming and landing on the beach, literally alongside the airfield, because the airfield had been quite badly bombed. And realising the fact that there was very little resistance, that really became, I suppose, the ink spot, whereby they were able to come in and reinforce, and they reinforced in strength, realising the fact that in Retimo and Heraklion it hadn't worked. All efforts were pushed to the west, and then building up the nucleus of enough people in the west, they then spread.
Flood in.
And meanwhile, they started the retreat, or the withdrawal, as we refer to
it. Don't say retreat, do we?
Yes. The withdrawal down to the south of the island to be extracted by the Royal Navy off to North Africa.
There was a man called John William Clayton. He was serving with the 23rd Light Anti-Aircraft Battery on Crete in 1941. And he was fighting alongside Maori troops from New Zealand. And in 1992, he described his experiences on Crete in an interview with the Imperial War Museum. And this is what he said.
That the defence of Crete depended entirely on the defence of these three airfields. It was attacked every day. And there was the Messerschmitt 109s and the Messerschmitt 110. Now those ones all carried a bomb, a fighter bomber. So they had a strategy of attacking from three different dimensions at different angles at the same time. And the first ones to dive in a strafing attack, they would come over the hill which was to the south of the airfield. The hill known as Hill 107, Point 107. And this was out of, they would be, in effect, diving out of the sun towards the airfield so that when the gun layers got onto target, they were being dazzled by the sun. And so from this headquarters position, I was sent down each day to the airfield to be able to report to the officer on the general morale of the men. So I went down each day with some difficulty. The men of Corporal Pace's gun, which was the one on the centre of the airfield, they were getting very, very shell-shocked. They were very nervous, and from time to time they would get a few rounds shot away, but then they would have to dive into the slit trench, for this strafing was enormous. We were being softened up, you see, ready for the invasion. We didn't quite realise that at the time. We just thought it was rather heavy bombing and strafing. For every type of plane came. High-level planes came with high-level bombing, pattern bombing. And Stukas came all day long in sevens. As soon as one seven had gone, another seven would come back, and they would circle high and then peel off and dive almost perpendicularly. The following morning was invasion morning. The bombing and strafing was very, very intense. No intervals at all. The fighter aircraft seemed to be making a point of trying to get the right angle to shoot into our slit trenches, and it was necessary to look upwards and see where the planes were coming from and dive into the opposite corner, and bullets would thud into the end of the slit trench that we'd just vacated. And this was such a cat and mouse game, and it seemed to go on for such a long time that the fear of being, well, each man was alone in a slit trench, you see. They were like foxholes. They weren't a trench to hold several men. They held one man only. The object was to break our morale. But really, I think it made us bitter. I don't think any of us lost any morale at all. Or suddenly we heard this very, very deep throbbing sound of very heavy engines. And I crouched lower, imagining that we were going to be bombed with something very much bigger than normal, when suddenly I heard the crackle of rifle fire, and instantly it occurred to me that parachutists were coming down. There was, for the first time, was rifle fire, crackling. So I looked up, and there the sky had many parachutists directly above us. And it was like lifting a weight from my mind. And I think all the other men thought the same. At last it was man against man, instead of against terrible machines. And the fear of being bombed to death or strafed, that fear was gone entirely because their men were coming down, you see. And with no fear of their men at all, for because of this very heavy strafing had conditioned us not to care, you see. Such the relief to be free of strafing and bombing was such that it didn't matter about their men. I jumped to the surface, and all the other men were jumping out of their slit trenches. And we were picking off these parachutists, and they seemed to be absolutely helpless. I think they were nervous, but there were very few of us, but we accounted for all of them. The empty parachutes were littered all over the small vines in the vineyard. They were only about 2.5 feet high. And the men had no cover from fire. really, we had no feelings of remorse. I didn't. It was relief not to be bombed, and the delight at being able to fight back at last. You see, we couldn't fight back against the Stukas. The area close to us had such a lot of parachutes, which were quite still. The men were dead, all but an odd one, for we did capture one, who he lay still, motionless, for about 3 hours. And this must have been torture, because it was really broiling hot. And suddenly he sweat stood up on his feet with his hands held high, and we took him prisoner. If he'd moved around a little without doing this sensible thing of leaping up with his hands up, he would have been shot, as had happened to all the others. Any movement attracted rifle fire, you see. So this chap suddenly dived up onto his feet, sprung up onto his feet, reaching his hands high, and no one had the heart to kill him. We took him prisoner.
And that's how they got away. So were many of them captured?
Most of them were, yes. Sadly, there was a rearguard action, and the best part of, realistically, just over 2,000 individuals were left on the island, some of whom tried to sort of blend into the local population and hid up in the mountains.
Oh, really?
And the Cretans were incredibly kind and basically looked after them very well. There was a resistance movement that looked after them.
Dangerous thing to do from their point of view.
Very dangerous. And sadly, this had a very bad effect on the Cretan population.
Reprisals.
Reprisals from the Germans, firing squads, and all sorts of really bad feeling throughout. And this, of course, led longer term to the much sort of fated kidnapping attempt of General Cripp. General Cripp was the German general in charge of Crete at the time, and two British officers, along with the resistance, decided to kidnap General Cripp, and much written about in the film Ill Met My Moonlight, 1957 film.
Okay.
And basically they managed to kidnap the general and spirit him away over a period of 12 days and got him on a boat over to North Africa. So there's an amazing story behind that as well.
What happened at the end of the 12 days? They take him back?
They took him off to basically Alexandria.
Right, so he never went back.
He was questioned and interrogated.
Yeah.
So the most amazing story behind that.
Well, there's so many stories, aren't there?
Absolutely.
This is why people have got to go on the front line walk to hear these stories. So after the battle then, the island was left in the hands of the Germans then.
It was, yes, and there was no attempt really to for the Allies to retake it at that stage.
At that stage, there wasn't any point, I suppose.
There was no point. They were very much concentrating on North Africa and the campaign against Rommel. And from Hitler's point of view, the reality of this was the fact that he decided this was the first and last time they were going to do a large-scale sort of parachute drop, blitzkrieg type operation. Because at that stage, he was really getting ready to push out towards the east, towards Russia, which, as we know from history in hindsight, that all went rather pear-shaped.
Because of the weather, yeah. So when did the British return? When did Crete fall into Allied hands again?
It didn't.
That was it?
That was it.
Until VE Day?
Yes, yeah.
And it was given up then?
Yeah.
So, frontline walk for Crete, first time ever then, Will, going in September, you said.
Yeah, so starting off, we're flying in on the 8th of September, and we are being transferred straight away down to the south coast. So effectively what we're doing is we're doing the opposite of the evacuation route.
Yeah.
So we're going from south to north, from sea to summit, rather than actually following the traditional route, which is north to south.
Yeah.
So we start off from the south of the island along the amazing coastline from where, sadly, a lot of people were evacuated from, sort of following the German invasion of Operation Mercury in May 1941. And we make our way up along the coastline, along some spectacular coastline and scenery, up through the Samaria Gorge.
Oh, that brings back horrible memories for me doing that.
which, as you're probably aware, is the longest gorge in Europe and the most amazing landscape to look at and scenery. Yep. And then basically staying each night in small guest houses,
right.
Whereby we'll have traditional Greek food every night. Lovely. And probably be offered all sorts of horrendous drink.
Because it's a small group, isn't it?
It's a very small
group. A glass
group.
Of ouzo would be
absolutely
taken.
The advantage on this particular trek, compared to what we've done in the Pyrenees in the past, is the fact that we're literally carrying what we need for that particular day.
So you're going to take all of
so
your luggage with you?
So we've got to take all of our luggage with us, because that's going to be transported ahead either by boat or by vehicle, and meeting up with us each night at the respective guest house.
How many days walking is there?
So it's 4.5 days walking. Doesn't go up to the sort of dizzy heights we had in the Pyrenees, but what we will be doing is going up to Kalule, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, which is the highest point above sea level, which is 1,631 metres. That's the highest point we get to. But in comparison to the Pyrenees, that's actually child's play.
Mm. And what sort of terrain then be walking on? Oh, coastal paths?
Coastal paths, very steep, rocky terrain, goat tracks, things like that, with lots of caves and amazing scenery all around.
It is a very different experience to what any of us have ever done before, isn't it? And what will they see along it? Would we be going to any of the cemeteries at all?
Yes, certainly. I mean, on the route down initially on day one, we'll be stopping off at the museum really to paint the picture so that people understand the context of the trek we're doing.
Yeah.
We'll then be talking a little bit about the evacuation when we get down to the south coast. And then as we go along, we'll be also recounting the stories about the kidnapping of General Cripe, or met by moonlight, as I mentioned before.
Mm.
And then when we move up to Hania, the capital longer term, we finish there. The final day will be spent doing a proper old-fashioned battlefield tour, whereby we go and visit Hill 107 overlooking Malamé Airfield, and we talk through the battle in the eyes of Lieutenant Colonel Leslie Andrew.
And from memory, isn't there a German cemetery close
there,
to there?
There is. There's a German cemetery on the forward-facing slope.
It's a beautiful spot, isn't it?
It is a beautiful spot, very much so, and actually, you probably get a better viewpoint from the German cemetery of the airfield than you do actually Hill 107, due to the olive groves that have grown there since.
Right. And the Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery, there's one on the island, is there?
There's one, but that's closer to Heraklion, which is where the British sort of garrison were in the first place.
Yeah, okay. And what sort of people are you expecting to... Will these be all military types, or will there be civilians like me as
Not
well?
Not at all. I mean, it is a complete mixed bag, if I can be so blunt as saying that. There are a most amazing group of people come together from all walks of life. Some of them have done a number of these frontline walks before, whether it be in Normandy or Western Front, or some more recently from the Pyrenees. And what a great bunch of people. They really gel together well.
All a bit mad, aren't we?
All a bit mad, but all of them have...
All different backgrounds.
All different backgrounds. All of them have links, possibly, to wanting to do this for the Army Benevolent Fund, whether it be they've had relatives who either sadly died at Normandy on the Western Front, or had links to what happened in the Pyrenees, or in this case, for Crete, specifically knew of relatives who had served there, but never really knew the detail of what it was all about.
And we always say this, there's no better way of seeing a battlefield than to walk it, and to given the opportunity to raise money for such a wonderful charity, to look after the soldiers of today, something that means a lot to all of us, that fundraise for the charity. What are the financial plans then? Is there an application fee?
So there is a sort of initial registration fee, which is quite expensive. It's £450. £425.
A little bit less.
And thereafter, we've got a fundraising target of quite high, about £3,400 per person.
Yeah.
Now, I know that's a big ask, but actually, with the loyal supporters we have, I think it is within people's sights to be able to do that. And it's not just a case of managing to raise that target prior to the actual trek itself. It's the follow-on. It's the fact that many people come back to England afterwards and tell people about what they've achieved and give lectures or presentations, and more money keeps coming in quite some many months after the
event. The end of the year, really, isn't it? We normally say it's to the end of the year. So it's not a question if you haven't got £3,000. Come September, you'll be turfed off the trek. That's not
absolutely
the case at all,
not,
is it?
You've
got to show that commitment.
And obviously we're very grateful for, you know, any money that can be raised. And realistically, as long as it covers our costs and it raises a bit more for the charity, of course, we're more than happy.
And what sort of things do people do to... Obviously, they ask friends and relatives to sponsor them, but I think people are a bit more creative than that, aren't they? You mentioned that people put dinners on and quiz nights and things.
Certainly, yes. I mean, from my own experience, I've seen people do exactly that. Set up a dinner for up to 30 or 40 people.
Provide the food.
Absolutely.
And drink.
Food and drink provided, local sponsorship from various firms.
Have an auction and a raffle.
Auctions. And there's so much we're lucky enough to be able to offer here, based at Sandhurst, for people to be able to come along and watch the Sovereign's Parade and have lunch in the Peninsula Room in Old College afterwards and have a guided tour behind the scenes afterwards. All of that raises a lot of money for our charity.
What, that would be sort of a raffle prize or an auction prize?
An auction prize.
Ah, that's a good idea. I hadn't thought of that. I might take you up on that one myself. Brilliant. So the actual trek itself, did you say, is 4.5 days?
4.5 days, yes.
So it's a whole, including the travelling time, it's got about a week then, is it?
It's 7 days. So sort of 8th to the 14th of September.
8th to the 14th,
yes.
Right. September, yeah.
And the final day of the trek, we could still call it the trek, but day 7 of the trek is actually a day at people's own disposal to be able to relax, recover in Hunya, visit the local sites.
Which is a nice place, isn't it?
Which
it's
is a lovely place.
It's an upmarket, touristy place, I think, now, isn't it?
Yes. And now, actually, what we've had on this particular trek is, because we've got people coming from all sorts of different countries, we've got people coming from New Zealand, one from New Zealand, three from Australia,
wow,
one from the United States, and the rest of us Brits.
Yes.
We've got some people going out on the same flight from London Gatwick on the 8th, but an awful lot of people are either flying there early or staying on
to have a holiday.
To have a holiday as well.
And I certainly recommend that. There are so many things to see and do in Crete, and especially going in September, it's not as hot as it would be in August or July. It's a very pleasant place to go on holiday, and you might need a holiday after doing the frontline walk.
Quite possibly.
I mean, it is, from my point of view, having done several of the frontline treks across Normandy and the Western Front, it is very challenging. This will be challenging in different ways, maybe shorter distances, but more physically challenging along the way. As you said, you make friends for life, as well as doing something worthwhile, raising money for a fantastic charity. You do make friends that you definitely wouldn't have met in normal life. You share so many experiences with them. You meet people from the army, you meet people from all sorts of different ways of life, and it does make you feel good about yourself, I think. I think that's the bottom line.
Very much so, and I think there's also a massive sense of achievement from the individuals that take part in this. It is a challenge, it is hard work.
Physically and mentally.
Physically and mentally, but really it's the fact that everyone gels so well. If someone twists an ankle or something worse, hopefully not, everyone is there and they muck in, they work as a team.
It's a team, isn't it? No one's going to get left behind.
No.
You stop for a break, you don't move off until everybody's ready. The last one has had their break, had something to eat and drink, and then you move off as a team.
Absolutely. And from my point of view, I always tell people, don't worry about thinking you're not fit enough, you're too old to do this. We go along at the pace of the slowest individual.
Yep.
And the slowest individual is usually me, because I'm the individual that's actually panting at the back. And the only reason we stop is actually, A, for me to be able to tell a little bit of history, but more to the point for me to get my breath back.
And I think the other thing is, so many people I've met along the way have had challenges in their lives. Not just soldiers that are suffering from PTSD and in some cases loss of limbs, but civilians as well that have had trauma in their own lives and therefore mental health issues. I know it's a big thing at the moment. And I myself have suffered from that in the past. And certainly being part of this ABF family and doing challenges like this, it helps those mental health issues. It really does. It doesn't feel like it at the time when you're being challenged, but certainly when you finished it, if you can deal with that, you can deal with any challenge in your life.
Now, you're absolutely right. And what is amazing as well is when you're out in the wilderness, when your mobile telephone doesn't work because you've got no reception, and you're not getting telephone calls from work hassling you for answers.
Or family,
for that matter. You have the opportunity to actually talk about things that you wouldn't normally talk about with complete strangers.
And that's where that bond builds, isn't it?
Absolutely. And people feel free to talk.
Trust.
And trust each other because they know that they are supporting each other. And that's very much what it's all about.
Yeah. And that, therefore, takes us civilians. It's touching that army world, isn't it? That's the spirit that you have in the British Army.
Very much so. And of course, all of this very firmly leads to what we do as a charity. And for instance, in the last financial year, we basically gave out £9.1 million to the wider army family. That's 75,000 people with a range or scope of a one-year-old right through to a 104-year-old.
All over the world.
All over the world, 51 countries worldwide. As we know, we're not a delivery charity. In other words, we're not up front rattling cage and telling people.
No, we're more subtle, aren't we?
We're more subtle, and yeah. We've basically dealt with 86 different organisations and charities to make sure the message gets out there and they support, on our behalf, the wider army family.
So there's two ways that the charity supports veterans. One is with direct grants, you mentioned the 75, and then the other way is to support smaller armed forces charities with grants to them, so that people like Combat Stress.
Absolutely that. I mean, for instance, in the last year, Combat Stress, we've donated £230,000 for them to work on our behalf to support the wider army family.
And people might not realise that. They might not be even aware of the ABF, because you say it's a very quiet charity in respect of, and it does rely, I think the other thing that attracted me to it as well, it relies very much on lots of volunteers, whereas some of the bigger charities have lots of people on salaries to do a lot of their fundraising, and most of it takes place through events like this, doesn't it, with lots of volunteers getting involved and working alongside, as we're doing today, alongside
yes.
the people that work for the charity.
Absolutely. And down here in the southeast, in particular, I have various county committees, all of whom are volunteers, and they're dedicated to the cause by running all sorts of events throughout the year. And I'm extremely grateful for what they achieve.
Fantastic. Well, thanks very much for that. As I say, we're recording this in the wonderful surroundings of the Sandhurst here. So much history, so many famous officers have come through these premises, so many stories to tell. We're going to look at one or two of those stories that have come through here for the podcast as well. And all it remains me to do is thank you for coming on and wish you the best of luck with this. And how can people go to the Soldiers Army Benevolent Fund website?
So if you go to the Army Benevolent website, under events, it is very firmly listed as an event, the Frontline Walk, Crete, Sea to Summit 2025. There's an opportunity to register on that. It gives you details of what happens each day, including a very short video that gives you a short overview of the type of terrain you'll be covering.
Okay.
And I very much hope that we might see some new people joining us.
I'm sure you will, and there's lots of exciting plans for the future as well, isn't there?
Absolutely. Yep. More to follow.
So a big thanks there to Will, and I hope people will sign up for, if not the Crete Frontline, the other frontline walks that can be found on the Army Benevolent Fund's website. But I thought it would just be useful to mention the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery that we talked about during the podcast, based at Souda Bay. It's a beautiful spot now that I visited myself a few years ago. In the port there, it's often where small cruise ships come in. The total number of Commonwealth land forces that were in Crete in 1941 was 32,000 men. And of those, they managed to get 18,000 away. They were evacuated, which meant that 12,000 were taken prisoner, and unfortunately 2,000 were killed or died. And the site of Souda Bay was chosen after the war. Graves were moved there from other locations. There was, in fact, four burial grounds that had been established by the German occupying forces. And there was also some of the dead had been buried by the locals in isolated sites and civilian cemeteries. And there's now, of those 2,000 that died, 1,500 Commonwealth servicemen buried or commemorated in the cemetery, and of those, 776 are unidentified. But there was a number of special memorials that commemorate a number of the casualties that are believed to be buried amongst them. And there's also 19 burials from the First World War. One of those is identified. 7 burials from other nationalities, and there's also 37 people that are buried there that are non-war burials. And as I say, if you do get the chance to go to Crete on holiday for any other reason, then please do make the effort to go to Souda Bay Cemetery. It is an absolutely beautiful spot, fantastic views of the bay, and it does give you an opportunity to reflect upon what happened there in May of 1941. So that's it for this week. Thank you very much again for tuning in, and thank you for the people that have left some fantastic reviews and ratings on Apple and Spotify in particular. If you can, please do so. It does help with the promotion of the podcast. And we'll be back again very soon with more Tales from the Battlefields. And we end, as usual, by the playing of the last post to remember those 2,000 Commonwealth soldiers that died in the Battle of Crete.